Capitol Report is a production of Senate Media Services.
This week, the Senate DFL announces a new majority leader. The co-chair of the Metropolitan Governance Task Force assesses the group's work, and the Republican House Minority Leader outlines caucus goals for the session. Stay tuned for this week's Capitol Report. Welcome to this week's program. I'm Shannon Lurkey. Following the announcement by Senate Majority Leader Carrie Dietzick that she's stepping away from leadership due to a recurrence of cancer, Senate DFLers elected Erin Murphy as the next majority leader.
Carrie Dietzick reminds us that we should look out for ourselves, get ourselves checked out, look out for our loved ones, and be kind. She's right. She has ably led this caucus for more than a year in a transformative period for the people of Minnesota. And we owe her an amazing debt of gratitude and our large thanks. We are committed together, 34 members, to make sure that we are working to improve the lives of Minnesotans. We're gonna do that in Carrie's honor. I wanna thank my colleague, Bobby Joe Champion. We've had a very good discussion this afternoon, and I'm honored to serve as the majority leader-elect for the Minnesota Senate.
Senator Murphy was first elected to the Senate in 2020, having served in the House of Representatives from 2007 to 2018, and was the House Majority Leader in 2013 and 14. Also, the Metropolitan Governance Task Force recently wrapped up its work. The legislature created the task force during the 2023 session to study options for reforming the governance structure of the Metropolitan Council, a policymaking body, planning agency, and provider of essential services for the Twin Cities metro area. Ultimately, the task force agreed upon 6 recommendations for the legislature to consider, and at the final meeting, members assessed the difficulty of reaching consensus.
You know, it would have been nice to come up with 1 or 2 recommendations to send to the legislature, but I think it shows the how complicated of a task this is. While we've had other task force work on this, this is the first time we've had a legislative task force with legislators sitting on it, working alongside of members of our community to tackle this issue.
The full recommendation, or maybe lack of a clear recommendation, might be a concern of some members or many members, but there was no particular consensus on anything, but I don't think that the discussion was not worth having.
I think it would be a dream for this committee to have come up with a single recommendation, and it would be unanimous, and it would go before the House and the Senate, where it would be unanimous, and it would go before both parties, and it would be unanimous. But that is just a dream. And no matter what we recommended, if we had come up with 1 or 2 or 100 recommendations, the legislature would still go through its process.
I really feel past reports have not really generated any reform that is needed. And so I feel that while it is great that all the ideas are moving forward for consideration, I don't believe the legislature will consider all of them.
I'm disappointed that we're not advancing a recommendation. I think some of what we saw was some folks around this table becoming more and more entrenched in the perspective that they brought to the table initially, and I'm disappointed in that.
I do believe that we are reflecting a growing public opinion that there is interest in change.
I think it's interesting that cities, counties, and the state legislature all have such disparate views of what our regional governance model should look like.
I certainly understand that not coming up with 1 recommendation or 2 is concerning, but I think it does reflect the reality that's out there. And I would concur with Vice Chair Pratt that this is different from previous task forces.
The 17-member Metropolitan Governance Task Force met 15 times over 6 months, with an additional 4 meetings devoted to public listening sessions. Joining me now to assess the success of the task force is the co-chair of the group, Senator Eric Pratt. Thank you for joining me.
Nice to be here.
This task force was not the first to look at restructuring the Met Council, but it was the first to come from the legislature with significant participation from lawmakers. How would you rate its success?
You know, I think I'd give us about a B minus maybe. We dove into a lot of issues around not only regional governance for our metropolitan area, but looking at how other regions do it. And other task force have done it, but I think having legislators on the committee gives us a little bit more ownership.
While there was not unanimous agreement on how to solve the problem, there was consensus on the problem. The report states that, quote, accountability is the basic issue. How might the legislature make clear to the public and to state and local governments ways of making the council more accountable?
You know, as I've looked back at the history, accountability has always been an issue with the Met Council. It started off with staggered terms appointed by the governor. And the idea was, well, it's not accountable to anyone, so let's make it accountable to the governor. Now, there's a problem in that we believe that the Met Council is accountable to the governor and not to the communities it serves. And so I think allowing our communities to have a greater voice in regional governance, in regional strategy, but also to be able to manage their own communities better with maybe less oversight, fewer directives, I think would be a good start. And then looking at the scope of the Met Council and seeing where we need a regional focus versus a community focus.
In the end, the task force put forward 6 separate governance reform proposals, 1 by Senator Scott Dibble, 2 by you, and 3 more by other members of the task force. But there are also submissions by individual members in an appendix. Does this exemplify the difficulty of reaching a consensus?
It really is a complex issue when you start digging into it. How large should the Met Council be? What kind of authority should it have? There were some members that thought it should be a full-time Met Council and we should give it more authority. There were some members that thought we should be taking authority and narrowing the scope of Met Council. A lot of discussions around transit and whether operating Metro Transit and being the planning organization for our transit systems gives the Met Council a conflict of interest. All those were things we talked about, but we never quite resolved, and one of the reasons why I give our task force a B.
Both of your proposals are centered on a COG approach, a Council of Governments. What does that mean, and why is that an attractive approach?
So a Council of Governance means that you have local communities sending a rep that they choose on their behalf to represent them on the regional council. Denver, for example, has 1 representative from each city and 1 representative from each county, making up a 58-member board. Our Met Council at 17, when you look at it comparatively, is really small. But I think the point that 4 of the 6 proposals had some version of a Council of Governments shows that we believe cities and counties are key constituents of the Metropolitan Council that haven't been represented very well.
And so then that gets the voices of the people closer to the decision making.
Right. Your cities and counties have a seat at the table.
In the committee, in media reports and in the minority report that is included with the task force report, you have mentioned the discrepancy in perception between urban and suburban communities. Can you elaborate on what you're talking about?
You know, out in the, it seemed like when we did the urban, we did a listening session in St. Paul and in Minneapolis. And the talk was about how the Metropolitan Council is affecting individuals. When you get out to the suburbs, we did 1 in Lake Elmo and 1 in Shakopee, it was more about the fact that we're growing and we're seeing overreach from the Met Council affecting our plans. Lake Elmo was one that I thought was really interesting, where the Met Council was demanding certain density and development goals, but the DNR won't give them the water permits in order to make the development happen. And so now we have 2 state agencies in conflict. And that's something that I'm hoping with a council of governments, with everyone having a seat at the table, can get resolved. And so it seems like the urban members have a more personal relationship with the Met Council, where the suburban members, it's more of a city-county relationship with the Met Council.
And you would like to see then a solution that gives more voice to suburban communities?
I don't know that it's not necessarily about giving more voice to suburban communities. It's about having Met Council representatives closer to the communities that they serve. So in my proposal, we expand the Met Council from 17 to 40. We have one rep from each county, and then we have 33 distributed count or proportional count districts that would then serve. The idea there being cities and counties can come together, and townships, and choose who they want representing their voice on the Met Council for their region. We already have city councilmen and township supervisors that were elected to represent their communities. Now they should be able to represent their communities on the Metropolitan Council.
Senator Scott Dibble, who's the DFL chair of the Senate Transportation Committee, his proposal is a hybrid approach, and thank you for outlining your proposal there. It would reform the Met Council into two separate bodies, a Metropolitan Regional Civic Council that is elected, and a Council of Governments comprising locally elected officials and appointees who are selected by a caucus of their peers. Briefly, what is your main concern with this approach?
Well, I think there's a couple of concerns. First of all, I think Senator Dibble was being very innovative when he put this together. 16 elected Met Council reps is about the same number of proportional districts we have today. Every Met Council rep represents about 2.5 Senate districts. And the question would be, can they really effectively be in touch with their communities with a district that large? Anything dealing with an elected Met Council, you start talking about partisanship. We can call it a nonpartisan election, a nonpartisan seat, but we're seeing party politics creep into local elections all the time. And when you look at Metro Portland, which is the only elected regional government, you start to see special interest money, out-of-state money flowing into these campaigns. When we want our representatives representing their communities, not special interests. I do think Senator Dibble's proposal probably gives a little more power to the elected officials than the Council of Governments, and I'm not quite sure how they interact when they share the planning function. What does that mean, and how do they do that 50-50 split? I think there's still a lot of questions around that proposal that need to be considered.
So that said, how would you like to see the legislature move forward based on the work of this task force?
So I'm going to put together a bill that represents the Council of Governments model. We'll continue to have conversations behind the scenes. I think there are probably some tweaks along the way that we can continue to make. But I think we have to have a real discussion, if not on the governance of the Metropolitan Council, and having our locally elected officials decide what's a better service for the city and what's a better service to be handled regionally. Maybe we can talk about some of the scope issues. I know Senator Dibble's been interested in removing construction from the Metropolitan Council. I'm certainly interested in clarifying or taking away the conflict of interest.
Senator Eric Pratt, very informative. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lawmakers have been meeting with their respective caucuses recently to decide on their priorities and strategies for the 2024 legislative session. Joining me in the studio to talk about some of the goals of the House Republicans is the House Minority Leader, Lisa Daymuth. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Shannon. Good to be with you today.
A new budget and economic forecast is about a month away, but the November forecast showed a surplus in the current biennium, but a, quote, structural imbalance beginning in 26-27, the next biennium. What's your view of the state's budget and economic health right now?
think it's important to remember that we had an almost $18 billion surplus last year. That is gone. We also increased the state budget by another $10 billion with taxes and fees. And so just taking that historically and then looking at where the forecast is at, I hear the word structural imbalance. To me, that's a deficit. We're looking at an impending deficit, and that's of great concern. And I really don't believe that we have a revenue problem in Minnesota. We have high taxes. We have a spending issue within how decisions are being made in the legislature.
And so you would like to see that be addressed, or you and your colleagues will make that point repeatedly, probably through the session?
I think Minnesotans are counting on us to make that point. I've still heard, being out in my district and in other areas of the state, what happened to all that money? How come I didn't really get that back? And as we've heard now, the people that did get the $260 checks, they're going to be taxed on it too. And so I think people are really trying to understand, yes, we'll invest in the state through taxes, but how are you using our money? And we will make that point throughout session.
Even your sessions are typically devoted to the crafting of an infrastructure package. Both the House and the Senate Capital Investment Committees have been touring the state over the interim, looking at potential projects. What types of projects would House Republicans like to see in a bonding bill this session?
Knowing that we passed a historic bonding bill this last year, looking forward, and I appreciate the work that all of the Capital Investment Committees have been doing, but knowing that we are looking at finances in the state, how they are, I think we have to be very smart with what we're doing. This will be a bipartisan bill, and it has to include things that are going to have equity across the state. Things like roads, bridges, wastewater, infrastructure things that we can really get behind. Those are the types of things we would want to see in a bill should we have a bill that comes forward.
Generally speaking, then, what are some of the priorities of the House Republicans this session? What would you like to see accomplished?
I think a couple of the things that rise to the top are the school resource officer issue. You know, that was something that was top of mind in August as kids were heading back to school. There was no fix on that, and we are still hearing about the issues that is faced. We've got schools across the state that have had a few different issues where they've removed their school resource officers, and I think it's important to remember that is not a mandate. Schools can choose to have those in their schools should they want and need that, but for them to be limited in how they're going to do their work has not been a good thing. So we're really looking for that fix, an actual fix that would make our schools, not just students, but staff too, safer. The other thing we're looking at is, you know, really no new spending. We have to be careful, as we talked about the budget earlier, no new spending. I don't think we need to do that. Do we need to reallocate or look at how we're spending? That would make the most sense. We have a tax bill fix that is going to be needed because of some errors. And so those are the things that are top of mind as we go forward.
If the legislature does not intervene, Minnesota will have a new state flag and a new state seal on Statehood Day, May 11th. House and Senate Republicans have said they will introduce legislation that will allow the public to vote on the new state emblems. Why put the issue to a statewide vote? Is that something you support?
You know, I would support having all Minnesotans at least be able to weigh in, not on what it's going to look like, but the idea of, do we need a new state flag or a new state seal? I think Minnesotans expect that. Outside of that, though, when we talk about spending, there was no fiscal note or actual study to know what is this going to cost the state to change our flags, to change our seals. We know Hennepin County alone, just an estimate of what it's going to cost them, $500,000 to start. Our counties can't afford that. You think of schools, you think of everything across the state. We're making it more expensive for cities, for counties, for everyone to do the work that they need, not including what is it actually going to cost the state to change that. That should have gone into the discussions.
Minnesota Care is a state health plan with low premiums for qualifying Minnesotans. On a recent program, House Majority Leader Jamie Long said that one of the House DFL caucus priorities for the session is passing a public option, thereby expanding Minnesota Care in Minnesota. How do Republicans view this issue?
Health care and health insurance for Minnesotans is very expensive. We know that we have reinsurance that's helped keep the cost down. We know that's looking to sunset in the next couple of years. That is very concerning. As far as a public option, we don't know the cost on that. And I would say if that's their priority, we need to start having those discussions. There were things passed last year, a study, but also the ability to implement that. The study's not even done yet. That doesn't come out till February 1st. We need to know where that's at before we start making great changes that would cost Minnesotans more. And we need to understand what it would do to accessibility and providers. There's more to it than just saying this is our priority, we want to push it through.
In 2021, then DFL Senator Carla Bingham partnered with now soon to retire Republican Representative Pat Garofalo on a bill to legalize sports betting. Minnesota remains the only state in the region that hasn't legalized sports betting, and that effort continues to garner bipartisan support. From your view, is 2024 possibly the year to legalize sports betting in Minnesota?
You know, I would say that with a full Democrat control, if they want to do it, they can. They have the votes. There is bipartisan support both for legalizing sports betting and against it. So I would say watch as the bills come through. We have to make sure that all of the interested parties, anyone affected, has a voice and has an input in any bill that would come forward. I would say watch and wait. I don't know if this is the year. That's a better question for the majority.
You've been vocal about the costs associated with the renovation and expansion of the state office building across the street, which is where the House of Representatives is housed. That renovation has already begun. We're seeing things get torn apart. It is an historic structure. So does that, at least in part, justify the price?
You know, when I look at it as a historic structure, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have done anything with the building. I think changes were needed. But to expand it to that extent with a price tag of $730 million is excessive. I think it's important to also understand that during the renovation, as soon as this session is over, they're moving every single person that office is in there, and again, part-time legislature, but they're moving staff, everyone, over to an empty office building on the campus, the Centennial Office Building. What I've asked is I've just said, could we just take an assessment of how much space we have on the complex that is being used full-time, used part-time, and then what's empty? And I think Minnesotans are asking us just to be wise with how we spend and what we do. So an expansion, doubling space at that excess is too much, given the fact that inflation, living our lives, affording everything is just harder. And I think $730 million is too much for Minnesota taxpayers.
House Minority Leader Lisa Damuth, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
One of the most unique Civil War artifacts on display in the state capitol is a flagstaff that barely survived the Battle of Gettysburg and now symbolizes the joining of the North and the South. Historian Brian Pease explains. We're standing here outside the Capitol Rotunda next to the flagstaff from the 1st Minnesota Volunteer Infantry Regiment, which is one of the most important artifacts in Minnesota history from the Civil War. Can you talk about the significance of this flagstaff?
Sure. It's once again, it's a relic of the Civil War. Men from Minnesota were carrying this flag in months before that the Civil War battle took place at Gettysburg, but more importantly, it was kind of held front and center on the second day when they made their famous charge down Cemetery Ridge, and on the third day at Pickett's Charge.
As a transplant to the state of Minnesota, I was surprised to learn how important Minnesota's regiment was in the Battle of Gettysburg. Can you talk more about that?
Yes, the second day of the battle, the Union line was about a mile in front of where the 1st Minnesota troops were located. And as the battle was progressing in front of them, the Union line started to crumble. Men were running through their ranks of the 1st Minnesota who were protecting a section of artillery pieces. And a general, understanding the consequence of men retreating in front of them, said, "I need to plug that gap." And the 1st Minnesota was the closest group of soldiers available. So he had them fix bayonets, charge down to plug that gap in the Union line. And as they made that charge, about a 300-yard charge, they jogged the first couple hundred yards and then ran full tilt in the Confederate forces advancing. They could see they were overwhelmed, and that's exactly what happened to them. So on that second day, within 15 minutes, they lost about 82% of their men. 8 of every 10 of them were killed or wounded.
On that third day of the Battle of Gettysburg, so we're talking about July 3rd of 1863, that's where the staff came from. Can you tell the story of the staff?
As the Confederate forces were advancing up Cemetery Ridge, the color bearer, Corporal Dane, was holding the flag. He was shot through the hand that splintered the flagstaff, the Union flagstaff, in half. He dropped the flag because of his wounds, and Henry O'Brien, who was next to him, picked up that flag, and he, having only half, the bottom half was already shattered, he snapped that off and threw it aside, and then he started advancing toward the advancing Confederates. Well, for our soldiers, this flag was one of the most important things you're fighting for, because the worst thing that could ever happen to a regiment is to lose your colors. And so if you see that color moving forward, you have to protect that man and that color, and that's what these men from Minnesota did. They charged after their flag, ended up hitting the 20th Virginia Infantry, that was the opposing side, and for about 10 minutes, 15 minutes, it was just a hand-to-hand slugfest, throwing, you know, fists at each other, rocks, clubbing each other with their muskets. And so it was right in the heart of that big picket charge that these first Minnesota men were right in the middle of that melee. And by the end of that, those men surrendered or retreated. The 20th Virginia lost their colors. So we were able to capture that color as well, the 20th Virginia flag, and that's still in the Minnesota Historical Society collections.
At the conclusion of the battle then, they had the Minnesota flag with only half of its staff, and they had the captured Virginia flag with a full staff. So who do you think decided to put these two things together, and what does it symbolize?
They did have the full length of the Virginia flagstaff, and they took the bottom half of that and spliced it together with the northern flagstaff, the 1st Minnesota Regimental flag. And so they put nails, and then they took a knapsack strap and tightly wound that around the splice so you could have a little bit firmer hold. And so that flagstaff with the tatters or the remnants of that 1st Minnesota national color were used until they pretty much were disbanded in 1864. So that was, it wasn't like put in a chest and put in the wagon and carried along. It was, they were still using that flagstaff as they were marching or moving into campaigns and battles.
And do you think soldiers recognized the significance of having the staff from both the North and the South as part of their battle flag?
I think so. I think, you know, you're taking a part of the Southern story and you're taking the Northern story and putting that together. And for a lot of these men, that's why they joined to fight in the Army and to fight in the Civil War, was to preserve the Union. So symbolically, what you're doing is you're taking that northern state and the southern state and putting them, joining them together with the whole idea that someday we'll have reunion again.
Why is the flag bearer so important in battle?
That was an important part of the communication on the battlefield. You have to remember, there's no radios, there's no communication except couriers, and a general sending a message to another colonel or another officer of a regiment in the battle by a horse and rider or a foot soldier, whatever it might be. And so they needed to know where to send that message to the colonel. And so the flags not only were that center for that those officers, but for the soldiers fighting shoulder to shoulder. So if you're kind of in the middle of a battle and you're trying to figure out where the flag is, and you can see it in front of you, it's like, well, I need to advance because the colonel says, or the officers have told us to move forward. If it's no longer in sight and it's behind us, we have to retreat. So for that soldier, you're fighting for the flag, but you're also looking for that flag for your directions on the battlefield as well.
Join us again next week as we delve into more topics affecting Minnesotans. I'm Shannon Lurkey, and on behalf of all of us at Senate Media Services, thanks for watching.